the 28th of August, was Equal Pay Day. The significance of that date being that it represents the extra 59 days post the kind of end of the financial year that women have to work to meet equal annual pay that men receive. It seems hard to wrap your head around that in 2020 this disparity still exists, doesn't it? So to talk us through the importance of closing this gender pay gap is Dr. Mariah Foley, Deputy Director of the Women and Work Research Group at the University of Sydney, who last week released a piece on the matter. Mariah, how's it going?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
No, my pleasure. So what does the gender pay gap currently sit at in Australia?
So the gender pay gap is currently sitting at 14%, and that is broadly the gap between the average earnings of full-time working men and full-time working women in Australia.
Right, I see. How does this translate, I guess, then to whole dollars as a general rule? What are those 59 days last Friday represented?
Yeah, so Equal Pay Day is a symbolic day to remind us of the persistence of the gender pay gap. So it marks 59 days from the financial year that women have to, an extra number of days that women have to work to earn the same amount as men. The important thing to remember about the gender pay gap, though, is that it is symbolic. It's there to remind us about the economic standing of women broadly relative to the economic standing of men in Australia. So it's not so much arguing that, you know, women in the same jobs are earning less than men, although we know that also happens. It's there to remind us broadly that women who are working full-time in Australia are not earning the same amount as their male counterparts.
Gotcha. How has something like this been able to, I guess, continue as long as it has? What stands in the way of equity, equality, and I suppose logic?
Yeah, there are various factors that contribute to the gender pay gap. So one of them that is very important is the tendency for men and women in Australia to work in different industries and occupations. So, you know, when you think about men, you might think about construction, trade, mining, et cetera. And when you think about women, nursing, aged care, childcare, education, community services, and so on and so forth. And Australia has one of the highest rates of gender segregation in the OECD. So men tend to work in quote-unquote men's jobs, women tend to work in quote-unquote women's jobs. And it just happens in our society that all of the industries and occupations where women are concentrated attract lower wages than the industries and occupations where men are concentrated, even when you require the same level of certification and training. So if you think childcare, for example, you need a certain level of TAFE qualifications, you need a certain number of hours, but they don't get paid as much as, say, men working in warehousing or as metal fitters who have identical amounts of training and qualifications required. So that gender segregation and the fact that we tend to devalue the work that women do is a significant contributor to the gender pay gap.
Right. Just very, very quickly, what is the OECD?
The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. So it is industrialized, the collection of industrialized countries in the world.
Gotcha. Thank you. So outside of those kind of, I guess, job types or this, that, the other, are there other maybe demographic indicators that influence this, maybe possibly background or this, that, the other?
Well, yeah, it would be very interesting to have data about whether there was also a racial pay gap. Unfortunately, in Australia, well, let me back up and say Australia is a world leader in terms of the data that we collect around the gender pay gap. So our country is the envy of many industrialized OECD countries in terms of the amount of data that we collect by law from private companies about the nature of the gender pay gap. We do not have the same legislation in Australia requiring the same level of detail of reporting around the racial pay gap. So evidence from abroad would suggest that one likely exists here, but we don't have that same level of data.
Right. What about into possibly... We hear the difference a lot between kind of men and women in terms of gender pay gap, but what about non-binary or maybe the gender fluid community? Is there evidence there, or do you have at least kind of some knowledge of that?
Well, so similarly, what I can say is that we know that people who don't conform to our kind of stereotypical notions about gender do tend to suffer added discrimination in the workplace. So this applies to, you know, women who are deemed to be too assertive will often pay a penalty because they're seen to be overly bossy. Mm. And men who, you know, who are attracted to caring professions, for example, and don't conform to a sort of stereotypical notion about, you know, typical masculine behaviors also tend to be penalized in terms of our expectations. So based on those studies, I think we can extrapolate to say that anyone who doesn't conform to stereotypical notions about how men should behave or how women should behave or how our sexual orientation or gender identification should be are likely to be discriminated against and see that kind of bearing in the jobs that they're offered and the wages that they're paid.
Yep.
But we don't have, again, we don't have mandatory reporting around that. So we can't say, you know, the pay gap for those communities is X number because we just don't have that data.
Right. What about, have we got at least some idea of how we go about closing the gap? Like, for instance, I'm not a CEO, so on surface level, it doesn't seem that I could do much. So how do we look at changing it? And I guess, what can someone like me, the average worker, non-CEOs do?
Well, okay, so there are, on multiple levels, we can look at this. So we can see that there are pay penalties that are embedded in our award system. So, for example, childcare workers, nurses, studies have shown that award wages in these quote-unquote feminized occupations are on average about 10% lower than they are in male-dominated awards. So we can regulate for that, and we can support regulation to change that. So that is one thing we can do as voters, as everyday citizens. Mm-hmm. Within organizations can do a lot to make high-quality, flexible work more accessible to everyone, but in particular to women. So very often women are forced to kind of pull back from more challenging and demanding roles or to move part-time or to move out of professional roles because of their caregiving responsibilities and because they can't get access to high-quality, flexible work. So giving workers access to flexibility is important. Men can also take a greater share of unpaid domestic responsibilities because it is the disproportionate burden of that work that is causing women to pull back from the labor market, right? So it's a multifaceted problem that can be addressed at multiple levels. So award wages, more affordable childcare, more flexible working options, and a better distribution of caregiving responsibilities in the home, those are all things we can be doing to address this problem.
Right. What benefits might this have on, I guess, the economy going forward, closing this gap, especially post-COVID, because it's looking like it might be tempestuous.
Well, we have the most educated female labor force, again, in the OECD. So we have the highest rates of female educational attainment. And women achieve higher rates of educational attainment in Australia than do men. But because of caregiving, because of the cost of childcare, because of the difficulty of balancing unpaid care with paid work, a lot of these very educated and highly skilled and capable women tend to pull back from the labor force at mid-career, at the point where they have children. So that is kind of like a farmer buying an extremely expensive, fancy piece of machinery and then deciding to let it rest fallow 50% of the time,
right?
And not using it to its full capacity. So, I mean, there is a moral argument to addressing this simply because I personally don't think it's acceptable that we undervalue the work that women disproportionately do to such a degree. But there is also an economic argument that says, why would you invest so much in training up your female labor force only to have them pull back from the labor market at that point? Why wouldn't you make it easier for people to balance work and care?
Absolutely. I guess it fails logic in a number of senses. Hey, I don't want to keep you too long, Mariah, because I know you said that you do have a busy morning ahead, but where might should people head, I suppose, if they want to get a little bit more informed on the topic?
Well, the Workplace Gender Equality Agency, which is our government agency that collects all of this magnificent data that we have about the gender wage gap, they have a lot of information there, including a report that we at the University of Sydney Business School prepared for them about gender equitable recruitment and promotion practices, lots of explainers about what the gender wage gap is and how to talk to people about this. Because there is a tendency to say, you know, I know two people and they both get paid the same, male and female, therefore this isn't a problem that really exists. So there's a fundamental lack of understanding still about what the gender pay gap represents and how we can overcome it.
Great. Sounds fantastic. Thanks so much for joining the show this morning, Mariah. I do appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. Have a good day.
And you. Cheers. That was Deputy Director of the Women and Work Research Group at the University of Sydney, Dr. Mariah Foley, discussing why closing the gender pay gap hasn't yet been achieved, how exactly it affects the economy, and I guess the importance and benefits of making it a thing of the past.